I'm speaking with Andrea Barrett, whose new collection of short stories is called Archangel. Andrea, the thing that immediately jumps out about these stories in your new collection is that they're all about scientists from various different periods of history. Can you talk about how you decided to put together this particular collection of stories?
Yeah, it's as with my last two collections, I think these look, when you see the finished book, as if I had a plan from the start and I knew where I was going. And in fact, I don't. I always just start with one story. In this case, it was a story called The Island, about a young woman going to a natural history summer school in 1873. And it's typical for me that as I do the research for one story and invent a set of characters, other avenues open up and lead me in other directions, to other countries, to other areas of science, to other problems. And so the stories accrete very organically. It's almost like watching a tree go from an acorn to a stem to something with many stems and a lot of leaves and fruits and things. I don't always have complete control over it. Sometimes I don't have any control over it.
So why do you like to write so much about science?
It's two things, I think. One is just simply I'm interested in it. I'm a crummy scientist myself. I had thought when I was young I would be one, but in fact, my brain doesn't work that way at all. But the guiding impetus for a lot of scientists I do share, which is simply wonder at the natural world, marvel at it, how did it come to be? In addition to that, which a scientist has, I have something that lies over that, which is sort of how do people get to be in this state of wondering at the natural world? What is it that drives human beings to be so interested in these processes? Why do they ask these questions? And that's what makes me a writer, I think, rather than a scientist. I'm trying to understand how people come to think that way and how they feel about the way they think. Two different areas, thinking and feeling, but they're not really very separate. How we feel about the way we think is in part how we choose what areas we think about. And that, as a fiction writer, really interests me.
Now, you said that you once wanted to be a scientist, but you were, what did you say? You were a crummy scientist yourself.
I really was.
So you majored in biology in college, right?
I did, and I went very briefly to a PhD program in zoology. I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I didn't even finish my first semester there. I had somehow managed to get through undergraduate school thinking that what I was doing was biology. But in fact, what I was doing was something more like the history of biology. As an undergraduate, if you're not very bright and in a research institution, you're essentially replicating other people's experiments. And what that's most like is cooking. And I'm actually a really good cook. I love to follow recipes and to cook. And biology lab can be like that. You follow the dissection guidelines, or in chemistry lab, you follow the experiment guidelines, and you do what it says, and what was red at the beginning turns blue, and that's really satisfying. But that's not science at all. I mean, science is, as I understand it, is a way of asking questions in a way that they can be answered. It's a way of looking at a problem and dissecting out its bits until you can shape experiments that can give you answers to those bits. And my brain so doesn't work like that.
How does your brain work differently then? Because I mean, obviously you're fascinated by the subject matter of what scientists do, but I guess the act of doing science doesn't quite work for you.
Yeah, the act of doing science day by day is actually boring to me. I'm embarrassed to admit that, but I have to admit that. I don't like being in a lab meticulously doing the same experiment over and over again. I like watching the people who are doing the experiments, and I like listening to their gossip, and I like reading their accounts of what their lives have been like as they pursued those problems. I just don't like pursuing those problems. I think the way my brain works is almost in the opposite direction. If I'm good at anything, it's at putting things together that are not usually put together rather than taking things apart, which is just another way of saying maybe my synthetic capacities are better than my analytic capacities.
Now, I've certainly read other literary fiction that delves into science, but it almost never with a kind of scientific detail that you go into in your stories. I mean, science is not just a backdrop for you to create a little atmosphere for your characters or your plot. The science itself seems to be central to all these stories, especially moments of scientific discovery or certain moments in history when a young scientist is challenging the old scientific orthodoxy. Are those the kinds of things that especially interest you?
They are, and that's really what engenders the stories in the first place. Again, this is sort of embarrassing. The conventional wisdom for a fiction writer is that we're supposed to start with our characters and everything else is secondary to that. And by that wisdom, science should be in the background, not the foreground. But truthfully, that it is my interest in certain areas of scientific history that tends to start a story. I will get very, very interested in the idea of the ether of space and trying to figure out how someone believed that at all, how they could believe it for so long, how they could believe it post-Einstein, post all the evidence. And then slowly something in me will begin to produce characters who could be in that state of curiosity and wonder. But it is actually the science that sets me down the path.
That's fascinating. So actually to start with kind of an abstract detail, sort of this debate over, you know, was there ether in the atmosphere, and somehow you turn that into a fictional story.
I know that's a sort of inversion of what we expect, but I would also say it's not an abstract detail in that sense. It's not an idea, what is the ether of space? It's an image related to that idea. So it's an image of, in this case, these gigantic whirling machines made of iron that Sir Oliver Lodge used to try and whirl past each other in a way that would tell him whether ether existed or not. It's a drawing of that. It's always something sensual, something I can see or feel or touch. It's jellyfish pulsing in the ocean and a line drawing of a gigantic jellyfish from the 1870s. And that image leads me into the idea, and those two things together lead me to the characters and the story.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of how you write about science. And I'm wondering if you could read a passage. And I'm thinking maybe from your story called The Particles.
Sure.
And I was thinking pages, like starting on page 144. Do you have that page there, 144?
I do.
So I was thinking starting with Axel was young himself, that paragraph.
Okay.
And then going to the near the sort of three quarters of the way down the next page on 145, ending with that paragraph, and if they could understand evolution then.
Sure.
Okay.
The Particles is a story that goes back and forth through time from 1939 when a middle-aged geneticist is involved in the sinking of an ocean liner that he's on. It was the first ship sunk by a German submarine in World War II. But in between accounts of that time, he's looking back over his life, and we're looking back at how he was trained to be a scientist. And this passage is when he's first in college, he first meets a real mentor, and it's his teacher, whose name is Axel, talking to him about what's so exciting about this field, that he's a 16-year-old freshman in college at the time. He's gone to school young. He's very, very curious and very excited. So this is him listening to his teacher and processing all that. Axel was young himself, just a few years out of graduate school, energetic and delightfully informal. He loaded Sam down with his own books, trusting that he could make sense of the material despite being only a freshman. When he discovered Sam's age, he laughed and said genetics was a young man's game. Alfred Sturtevant had been only 19, still an undergraduate, when he'd devised the first chromosome map. Calvin Bridges had been an undergraduate, too, and a bottle washer like Sam, when he spotted the first Vermilion mutant. Who knew what Sam, the perfect age at the absolutely perfect time, might do? Theirs was a new field, Axel said, a whole new world. In class, Axel brought new terms and concepts alive with his arms, slicing the air like a conductor, his thick air sticking up in spikes. They were after more than just the study of vague factors or mysterious unit characters, he said. The gene was not simply an abstract idea. Genes were material. Heredity depended on chromosomes, forever splitting and recombining. Units of heredity, genes, must be arranged like beads on a string, particles invisible to the eye but visible through their actions, ordered along visible chromosomes. Let the older generation argue about immaterial factors, vitalistic forces, the possibilities of organisms passing on changes caused by will or experience. The truth, Axel emphasized during Sam's first semester, was that the particles of heredity passed from one generation to the next and could not be influenced by what had happened to the body. Every living individual had two parts, one patent visible to our eyes, the me you see, the tree you touch, that was the somatoplasm, and the other latent, perceptible only by its effects on subsequent generations, but continuing forever, part of an immortal stream, that was the germplasm. Phenotype, genotype, Sam loved repeating those words. Concepts made visible, Axel said happily, through our own flies. So Sam couldn't swim, so he hated his history class. When he listened to Axel talk about his work, now their work, he was entirely alive. If they helped elucidate the way genes were arranged and transmitted, then they'd begin to understand heredity and variation. If they understood that, they'd begin to glimpse the workings of evolution. And if they could understand evolution, then...
Oh, that is such a lovely passage. I have to say, one thing that strikes me is that I'm guessing a lot of writers would sort of be scared to go into that much detail about science in a work of fiction, you know, the fear being that you might lose your readers along the way.
You know, I do worry about that, but there doesn't seem to be anything I can do about that except to just trust that as, you know, human beings, we all share the same interests at some level. I just have to trust that if I'm curious about those things and I'm interested in those things, then other people are too. Certainly the fiction I write is not for everybody, and that's okay. It's okay if it's just for some people. But I think there are a lot of people who really are interested in science. And, you know, one thing is the science I write about isn't science that's done right now, which actually is too hard for me.
Well, and it's the history of science, really,
that
is your subject. And each of these chapters is set in a particular moment in time. In fact, you have the date at the beginning of each story. Why so interested in the history of science?
Again, it feeds into understanding what we understand now. It's also, when you delve back into the history of science, by the time I'm reading work that was published in 1920, 1921, 1922, which is the work Axel is trying to explain to Sam, that's so long ago now that those concepts have almost unconsciously entered our brains, which means I can understand it, and so can anyone who reads the book. It's not that hard. We've unconsciously absorbed a lot of it already. And it's also the case that the history of science, any example that we choose, will have adhering around it all sorts of theories that were equally popular at the time but have since been proved to be wrong. And that also really interests me. When we read the New York Times now and we read about a new treatment for cancer or a new hypothesis about how Lyme disease works, unless we're working in the field ourselves, it all sounds right, it all sounds true, it all sounds plausible. When we look back to something that happened in 1920 or 1873, we have the advantage of knowing which of the 14 theories that looked plausible at the moment turned out to be true. We don't have that advantage in our own time. But when we look at scientific history and we see how many concepts rose up, even dominated the field for a while, and then were proved to be utterly wrong, it gives us a feeling for what in our own lives that is put forth as truth might also be wrong. It makes us, I think, more usefully skeptical about what we're told to believe in the world now.
That's fascinating. As a fiction writer, do you find certain advantages of writing historical fiction rather than about the contemporary world? Does it give you more freedom in some way?
That's a great question. I think it does give me more freedom. I'm not sure it works that way for every fiction writer, but if you assume that we all have our own set of neuroses and issues and strange areas we can't go near and things we can write about and things we can't write about, Every writer does have that set of things, and we work with those or evade them differently. And in my case, something about my natural reserve, my inability to kind of go out in the world as a reporter and really investigate things actively, that makes history more amenable as a field to me, easier really, because it's more book-oriented and less crashing through the world now-oriented. I'm shy.
Do you do a lot of research before you write these stories?
I do a lot before, and I do much more during, because I always start the stories with an idea of what they're about. I have to. You have to start someplace. But I'm always wrong, and sometimes I'm wrong, you know, by a continent and half a century, and I'm not kidding about that. So what all the research I do up front, I wrote, there's a story in this book that touches sort of briefly on the idea of the blind cave fish in the Mammoth Caves of Kentucky that takes place in upstate New York in 1908. But I thought for almost a year that I was going to write a story about guides taking naturalists around those caves in Kentucky specifically to see those fish. So I did an enormous amount of research about the Mammoth Caves of Kentucky and the blind cave fish in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, and ended up writing a story set half a century later and across the country. So you can see where I had to do the different research in the middle of the story.
So what kind of research do you do? Do you read histories of these periods, or do you try to go back to primary documents?
I go back to the primary documents whenever I can. I usually will start with a general history just to get oriented and to start getting my bibliographic ducks in a row. But as soon as I can find the documents from which the people writing the history wrote the history, then I go back to them.
So letters, is that the kind of thing you're looking for?
Letters, photographs, a lot of visual material, drawings, photographs, even paintings, sort of common cultural artifacts at the time. I like to look at old newspapers, not just for the articles, but for the advertisements and the sort of incidental material around the edges. Really anything I can put my hands on. If I'm working with a scientist, as I was with most of these, I like to go back and read the textbooks that they would have read when they were young, which are not very hard to get hold of. It's easy for me, relatively easily, to go back and, say, get a biology textbook from 1870 or 1880. A lot of scientists in the 19th century also wrote popular science, so it's really easy for me to find their books. And that teaches me two things, both the science, but also the tone of voice in which they conveyed the science, what they thought was important, who it was they thought they were talking to, how distant they felt from what they perceived to be their audience. All that helps me build a character.
You know, I'm guessing a lot of people would say, you don't have to do all that research. I mean, you're writing fiction. You're not writing history here.
You
could fudge the details and
I know.
People wouldn't notice. But obviously you care.
I do care. But I know that those people are right. I spend way, way too much time doing this. And so it makes me a very slow writer. Each of these five chapters or stories took better than a year to do. And, you know, there's a level on which that's just silly. Why don't I just write it already? But my imagination is somehow put together such that I can't write them unless I am fully at home in that world. And that's different from knowing just a few background facts. I have to absorb enough material thoroughly enough that I can briefly experience the world and feel the world as my characters feel it. And it turns out for me, that's just a lot of material.
Well, it almost sounds like you would feel dishonest if you got some of those historical details wrong. It wouldn't feel right to you, even if your readers wouldn't notice.
No, I would be miserable and I would be mortified. I know that most people can't tell if I've got a fact right or not, but some people can. Some scientists somewhere or some intellectual or scientific historian or someone who just loves science has been reading it for a long time, you know, someone will know. And if we're not going to get those things right as fiction writers, why are we doing this? You know, what's the point of making a dishonest book if we want to move people and touch them and make them see the world in a different way? It wouldn't feel right to get those things wrong.
Now, I'm curious, do you collect scientific artifacts from the past?
I do. My house is a disaster. It's, you know, I have a lot of old books and a lot of, you know, an anode from an old X-ray crystallography machine and a lot of fossils and bones and all objects collecting dust every day. And do I dust? I do not.
So why? I mean, is it to, I don't know, somehow have that visceral connection to the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to hold in my hand what Henrietta was holding in her hand. I want to, you know, if she's going to feel a jellyfish, I want to feel a jellyfish. If someone else is going up in a biplane, I want to go up in a biplane. I do need to feel and touch and experience those things as my characters do.
Now, a number of your stories, I mean, not just in this collection, and in some of your previous books as well, deal with real historical figures. I mean, you've written about famous scientists, Linnaeus, Mendel. One of the ones that you write about in your new book is probably the most famous American biologist of the mid-19th century, Louis Agassiz, who is probably best known today as the person who opposed Darwin's theory of evolution, which has kind of made him a tragic figure. I mean, this brilliant guy who got it wrong. Why did you want to go back to him?
I've been interested in him since I can remember, really. Years and years ago, I wrote a book, which I think is out of print now, called The Forms of Water, which has nothing to do with him overtly, but the title and some of the imagery in that book comes from a late 19th century book that is about Agassiz and his glacial experiments. And so I knew of him first as someone who did that first brilliant work on the Ice Age and the glaciers. And it was much later in my life that I understood his relationship to Darwin and this giant tragic mistake that he made. And of course, then I just got more interested in him. And I do write about Darwin's world a lot, if not Darwin. And I read an awful lot about evolution and the way it's moved through history and across continents. And he, Agassiz is just squarely in the middle of that, opposing. And he opposed it until the day he died, even when I think he actually knew by then that he was wrong. He had so much invested, though, in upholding this other theory that he couldn't let go. And, you know, that's a trait a lot of human beings have, including myself. It's just not with science, but that inability to change as we grow older, to let go of a passionately held belief from our youth. We all have that, or we all potentially have that, and he's the great model for that in some ways. So that's part of what draws me as a fiction writer. He was also just a really fascinating character. He had hundreds of students. All of American biology was shaped and colored by him. They knew he was wrong. They knew he was wrong even when they were working with him.
Even though they wanted to go to be his protege, even though they knew he was wrong about evolution.
Yeah, he was so, I think, electrifying in so many other ways. So brilliant, such a good teacher, so smart about certain aspects of biology. They did want to learn from him. They just had to kind of put blinders on this one area. And then they would go forth and lead universities or lead research institutions, happily promoting Darwinism. But he was dead by then. They could get away with it.
Well, I think one of the things that's so fascinating about the history of science is that there are these moments when you're not sure which strand of science is right. You know, maybe at this point, I mean, it was kind of clear that Darwin was right and Agassiz was wrong. But, you know, go back 20 years earlier, who knows? And, I mean, whereas today we kind of think, oh, okay, the scientists are saying this is the way the world works and, you know, who are we to question that? But when you go back into the history, it could go in different directions. And it's profound to think about how uncertain we can be about the way the world works.
That, you know, that's the crux of it right there. You just explained that much better than I ever could. That's why the history of science is interesting. That's why history is interesting. The history of science is just a subset or a model for all history. But this issue of, you know, how do we know what we know? How do we think we know what we know? When do we decide? When does a theory about the world in any of its aspects, whether it's scientific or philosophical or biological, when do we accept one theory and discard another? When are we willing to revise what we've accepted for so long? that's just really interesting. And that whole structure is in itself, that's the way we move through our lives. I mean, when we're children, we think about the world and ourselves one way. That changes some as we get older. If we're lucky, it changes a lot. If we're lucky, it changes again and again. Or it doesn't change. People get frozen at certain points in time in certain sets of ideas and beliefs. And what happens to you if you get frozen and you can't change?
One of your subtexts, I guess you could say, in some of these stories is your characters are often young women who want careers in science, but it was really hard back in the late 19th century, the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of what it was like for a woman back then to want to work as a practicing scientist?
I think I do have some sense after all these years of reading around and thinking about it. It seems impossibly hard and impossibly frustrating. I'm of an age when feminism was just opening out as I was becoming a young woman. And so mostly I could do what I wanted. And not to have been able to do that, not to have been able to pursue an interest in biology, even though it didn't turn out to be right for me, it's hard to imagine what it would be like to have that giant wall in front of me. At the same time, I've known a lot of women in certain fields of science who were working in what are still largely male fields, and talking to them, some of them much, much older, about what it was like to be a young woman coming up in the 20s and 30s and 40s in areas of physics that were, sometimes they were the only woman around, how they survived that, how they made their way. That was very illuminating for me and very interesting. And I still feel I haven't written the thing I want to write about that. I have something that's been percolating in my brain for a long time, but I don't know if I'll ever find the right way to do that, the right set of characters in the right field. But it does really interest me.
Tell me more about that. I mean, what does it take for it to work for you? And I don't know if you're talking about a short story here or a novel.
I'm guessing probably a novel. Well, for one thing, I have to be able to understand the science that the characters are wrestling with. And in the case of the women I'm thinking about, the science is very hard for me. It's sort of right at the edge of what I can understand, or maybe it's past that edge. So that's been an impediment. It's like, if I can't understand it, how am I going to write about them wrestling with it? And then I have to find a situation, a moment in time that in some way crystallizes all those problems enough for me to set off. And then I have to be able to invent characters that can make that come alive. And that hasn't happened quite yet. But I've only been thinking about this for 6 or 7 years, and that's actually a short time for
only
me.
Only 6 or 7 years? How long does it
I'm
take?
I'm sorry, that's pathetic.
How long does it take for a story to percolate? That, I mean, do you have some stories that you've sort of been mulling about for 20 years?
I certainly have characters I've been mulling about for 20 years. And the first story in Archangel, the one called The Investigators, that's set in a place that I've been mulling about and writing about tangentially for more than 25 years, which is the little village of Hammondsport, New York. But I never set anything fully and firmly there in the past before until just last year.
Wow.
So I don't know. I'm baffled at my own process, which is so opaque and so slow and so bizarre that it's really hard for me to explain it to people. But
isn't that what creativity is all about? You can't really explain it at some sort of deep level.
Yeah, all you can do, the way people get better as writers or painters or scientists, the way you get better in any field that involves a large component of the unconscious and creativity, really just has to do with, you know, learning what your own strangenesses are and going with it. And at this point, it's like, okay, I have to sit with something for 10 years before I can start a story, and then I have to do 2 years of research, and then it's all going to end up being 15 pages long. It's just a big whatever at that point. It's like, fine, that's the way I work. I know it doesn't make sense, but it works for me. If I give in to that and I don't excoriate myself for it and I'm just calm with it, then work will come out. It will come out slowly, and it won't be for everybody, but I will make work if I just allow myself to give into this very odd process.
Now, there's a lot of talk these days about the growing divide between science and the humanities. Of course, it's the thing that C.P. Snow talked about more than 50 years ago in his famous lecture called The Two Cultures. Do you see this as part of your project to try to find connections or build bridges between science and literature?
You know, I don't think of that consciously when I'm writing a story, but after they're done, I look back at them and I think, oh, maybe that would be smallly useful in that way. If someone who's not by nature interested in science finds even a glimmering of beauty or wonder in the natural world or in the processes of scientific investigation through a story, then I would feel really happy. Scientists accept that art and literature and dance and music are beautiful and life-enhancing. They're very curious as people. They delve into all those fields. But sometimes humanists and artists can have a peculiar blind spot when it comes to science. They don't always see that it's equally beautiful and interesting and resonant and rich with images. I'm not sure why that is. It's probably the way our schools run. It must have something to do with the way we're educated. I don't think it's built into us.
Do you see parallels between the act of doing science and the act of writing fiction?
Yeah, I think they're almost exactly the same thing. I mean, no good scientist I've ever known was wholly a rational or logical being. They're driven by by intuition and unconscious guesses just as much as writers and artists are. They're able to break those steps down later into something logical and linear when they design experiments. But the impetus from the experiments comes from the same odd hidden place that the impetus for a musician or a writer does. You just wake up wanting to do something, or you see something, or you know something, and it sets you down a path. You don't know why you're going down the path. You don't know why that's interesting. It just is. And if you're smart, you follow that. And I think scientists work very similarly in those early stages.
Fascinating. Wondering if we could end with another reading. And I don't have anything in mind. And if I don't know if there's a short passage that would illustrate any of these ideas that we've been talking about that would come to mind for you. I'm sort of thinking could be anywhere from a paragraph to a page long.
You know, I was wondering about maybe something from towards the end of The Ether of Space, when Sam, the grown-up in the particles that we were reading from earlier, he writes a little essay about what he understands science to be, and his mother reads it. And maybe that will express some of what we're talking about here.
Sure, that would
be
great.
Does that sound okay to you?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, this is from The Ether of Space. From Lodge's longing for his son had come, Sam argued, an entire theory of etheric transmission, which, if it wasn't true, he himself believed it was not, was still a marvelous example of how science was influenced by feeling. About the connection between that feeling and the construction and testing of any scientific hypothesis. Lodge had suggested in his lecture that Einstein's theory had been tested but not completely proven by the eclipse experiments. His book suggested that his experiments after his son's death offered a similar level of proof for the theory of survival of personality. Sam's mother, Phoebe, slowed down and read each word. My father died when I was 4. I miss him all the time. For years, I was sure he was up in the air somewhere among the stars he studied. I listened for him every night. I thought that from someplace deep in space, he would try to contact me. When we moved from the house where I was born, I was terrified that if he sent a message, it wouldn't reach me. Later, I convinced myself that he could find me anywhere, at any distance, and that the fault was mine. If I couldn't hear him, it was because I didn't know how to listen. If I stretched myself, broadened myself, I'd be like a telescope turned onto a patch of sky that before had seemed blank. Suddenly, stars would be visible. Nothingness would turn into knowledge. Across time and space, my father would reach out to me. Eventually, I had to give up on this idea, but as I listened to Lodge's lecture, I fell back into it, and for a few minutes, I wanted so badly to believe him that I did. I understood the ether of space to be exactly as Lodge described it, a universal medium that transmits not only electromagnetic forces, but also the thoughts and longings of the dead. Only when I looked around at the audience and saw them all believing the same thing did I realize what was happening. I don't understand the physics behind Einstein's theory, and I don't believe in the existence of a spirit world, but my introduction to Lodge's work changed the way I think. I don't know, and I don't believe there is sufficient evidence yet to prove, whether the ether is real, the way the atmosphere is real, or the way the equator is real. Whether Einstein's theory has been proven, or Lodge's theory of survival of the personality after death, or neither, or both. I don't know whether my father exists in some ethereal form or only in my heart. What I do know is that the questions we ask about the world and the experiments we design to answer them are connected to our feelings.
That is quite wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for figuring out that was a good place to go.
Oh, yeah. No, that was great.
You led me there.